I'm standing now on the Menin Gate. It's approximately 9:02. The policemen have just moved into the road. That would be, I think, the last car just passed through. Here comes another one. It is now right on time. The two policemen are moving out into the road, and the buglers will shortly be ready. The traffic has stopped in about 15 seconds from now. You will hear the beginning of the last post.
Hello again. Welcome to episode 3 of From a Whisper to a Bang, a podcast about remembrance and a journey in historical empathy around my family's ancestral war service. My name's Megan Spencer. And you might recall that we started with the story of my late grandfather, Corporal Harry Spencer, an Australian infantry soldier who became a prisoner of war in Germany during World War II. And last episode, we visited two of those memorial sites in situ. Well, this time, we'll rewind two or so decades to visit the very first global conflict to afflict the 20th century, World War I, as my pilgrimage takes in the story of Harry's older brother, Richard, an infantry soldier also with the AIF, but the first one. It also takes in an entire city as a war memorial, Ypres, or Ypres as it's called in Flemish, in the region of West Flanders in Belgium. And there's a pretty good chance that I'll use both those names interchangeably today.
They shall grow not old as we who are left grow old.
So just like Mr. Hunter, the gentleman you just heard in that historic 1960 recording, I too now find myself at the Menin Gate in Ypres. My husband Oliver, who you also met last episode, and I have taken another road trip, this time from his parents' home near Düsseldorf. We're waiting for the nightly ritual of the last post ceremony to begin. I can hear just so many different accents. My microphone even picks up an Irish fella telling off a couple of young French women for talking. Such is the reverence of the occasion. Originally instigated in 1928, the last post takes place here nightly, come rain or shine, and now at the permanent time of 8 p.m. to pay homage to those from the British and Commonwealth forces who fell on the Ypres battlefields during World War I in defence of the town and also the nation.
Welcome to this daily ceremony. Please do not applaud during or after the ceremony. Thank you.
So we're packed in here like sardines beneath the solemn and spectacular arches of the Menin Gate Memorial, which is at the mouth of the cobblestone city. It's covered in the names of 55,000 of the missing from the British Empire forces, who died on the Ypres front line, or salient as it's known, in World War I, including those of over 6,000 Australians with no known grave. I've never seen anything like it. Looking up, I see walls that go on forever, with names stretching up to the sky, and it feels as if every single surface carries someone's story. The living are surrounded by the traces of the dead. There's no escape. And it's here I realise just how important names are to remembrance. Memorials can take many forms, but perhaps none more powerful than a name. To be seen, to be heard, and individually acknowledged. It's such a very human need. And I don't mind telling you that perhaps, like Mr. Hunter might have been here, I'm also feeling a little bit overwhelmed. I mean, World War I, it's just so enormous, so destructive. So many millions were involved. I mean, where do you start? Well, right here, perhaps. Right here in these fields where so much took place. Right here where the firemen's bugles sound night after night.
Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. But at the going down of the sun, and in the morning light, we will remember them.
In the year of 1899, twin boys were born. Their names were Richard Bailey and Hugh Bailey. Richard, or Dick, was an apprentice carpenter and cabinet maker with a firm alongside the Clifton Hill Railway Station. Dick, I can recall, was a tall and well-built chap. My memory of him is only from the years 1914 and 1915, just before and when he enlisted to go to the 1914-18 war. He had difficulty enlisting as he was under the acceptance age. And to enlist, when so young, parents' consent was needed. Only one or other of the parents' signatures was necessary on the enlistment paper. Neither of the parents would sign the paper, so my elder sister, Queenie by name, was called upon by Dick to sign my mother's name. Dick changed his given names to Charles Richard and was accepted into the army. It is to be noted that Queenie was a schoolgirl when she signed the papers.
The name of Private Richard Bailey Spencer, No. 5218, Australian Imperial Force, or Charles, as he enlists under, is not on the walls of the Meningate Memorial. Harry's older brother has a known grave just a few kilometres south of Ypres, at Spoilbank Cemetery. He was killed in action on the 31st of January 1918. So dying very young, only a handful of Spencers ever met him 100 years ago. Yet to this day, Richard's still spoken of fondly at family gatherings, with some relatives even referring to him as Richie, almost as if they know him. He's a source of reverence and loss in the family. So I really feel I need to know more about him. Almost 100 years since he was buried here in Ypres, as best as I know, this will be the first time a Spencer family member has visited his grave. I want to go to Ypres to find his final resting place and to find out exactly what happened to him. But first, let's hear a little bit more from Harry.
Dick, or CR, joined the 14th Infantry Battalion and went overseas to Egypt for further training. Then on to Europe with this famous battalion, a member being Albert Jacka, Australia's first winner of the highest award for bravery, namely the Victoria Cross. Dick was eventually killed in a place in Belgium named Ypres. He was not quite 19 years of age.
Swept up in the surge of enlistments taking place in Australia in October 1915, as Harry writes in his memoir, Richard enlists in Jacka's mob, the 14th Battalion, in Melbourne as a boy of 16, eventually becoming a soldier of 18 in the muddy trenches of the Western Front. First in France, then Ypres, where he's buried. And it's clear from what he writes, Harry did look up to him, and to Hugh, Richard's identical twin, who also enlists underage at 17, again with the help of younger sister Queenie, to whom Harry refers as their second mother. Born second out of the 13 children in Harry's family, Richard becomes the eldest after firstborn William dies in infancy. Dick, as Harry calls him, was named after their father, Richard Thomas Spencer. Harry writes,
"My father was a very hard-working man. He was a master quarryman, being employed as a foreman for 44 years. It can be said that he was a heavy drinker, but he never neglected his work or family. He was an extremely proud family man. Loyal to King, Country and God was his motto."
Mary Rebecca Bailey Spencer, my great-grandmother, Richard Senior's wife, had their 13 children between 1897 and 1917, from the ages of 25 to 47. Harry writes she had a big heart and a talent for healing people, and there were some other fables around her origins too.
"Mum was taken from her parents' home by her uncle, a man named William. She lived in Liverpool, England, and her mother and father were Baileys of Barnum and Bailey's circus fame. She was 8 years old at the time and came out on a paddle steamer named P.S. Melbourne. was boarded to a childless elderly couple in Fitzroy. Mum often discussed how her Uncle William used to pay these people each fortnight. Also, as to how cruel these people were to her over the 14 to 15 years that she lived with them.
True or not, by all accounts, Mary had a pretty rough life. When her son Richard died at the end of January 1918, Mary Spencer had already lost five children. As my cousin Joe pointed out to me, by the time she died in 1944, aged 72, Mary had outlived eight of her 13 children. Eight. Now, it's bad enough if you outlive one. And now Richard, her eldest, was another. No wonder she didn't take it well.
Wednesday, January 8, 1919, Mercil Road, Alphington. Dear Sir, I hope you'll excuse the pencil, for I'm short of ink. Take notice of me well, sir. I gave my twin boys for the front. I would have also given myself for the front, when the men would not stand their ground, but they were not taking women.
Mary was heartbroken, then angry, when Richard died, firing off letters to the army regarding the months-long delay in the return of his effects and receipt of any commemorative medallions.
What am I thought of now? For I got one killed on the front a year ago on the 31st of this month, and I can't even get a word about his grave and also what belonged to him. Not even a card out of his pocket. Is this how you treat the poor mother? Is this what you think of them sort of people? We don't even get a bit of ribbon to show our boys have done their bit. Would it be nice for a mother to show and say that this is the medal he got when he's lost his life for you? But at the same time, I'm a proud of my twin boys. If I had 20 more boys, they would also do their bit for their country. Don't forget this poor worried soldier mother, for I'm a British-born woman. I feel the loss of my son very much, especially when they're all coming home now.
Hugh did return from this world war and went on to serve in another 20 years later, eventually passing away in 1962 after an entire career in the service. Mary got one of her twins back, but she was still devastated.
Now, sir, don't forget me. From a broken-hearted soldier mother, Mrs. M. Spencer, my dear son, number 5218, 14th Battalion.
So it's been a hectic time moving back to Australia, saying goodbye to friends and family after 2 years of living here in Europe. In October 2017, my time's running out for this pilgrimage. So when I lob up then to Ypres under its grey pre-winter skies, save for catching my breath, the scant few paragraphs about him in Harry's memoir, and a certificate to show where Richard's grave is, what you've heard so far is pretty much all I have to go on. So I arrive in Ypres, hoping to do some detective work and to find some people who might be kind enough to help me. Also, to see what being in this landscape might reveal to me about Richard's fate, as Germany did when I visited the places Harry had been in during his war service. I've got no idea what to expect, but there's a whole world of detail waiting for me. Here in Ypres, it's nigh on impossible to not be struck by the sheer ornateness of the town and how pristine it is. This is an ancient place. Flanked by a centuries-old fortified wall with beautiful alleyways, medieval houses, shops, hotels, in the midst of its sprawling town square is the huge and iconic Cloth Hall. And on the rare occasion that the clouds break, I catch it glimmering in the sun. Its Carillon bells go off every quarter hour. And during the First Battle of Ypres, towards the end of 1914, the hall was shelled by the German army and then burnt down. Now, though, you'd never know a war had taken place here, nor one that had razed that hall and the entire town to the ground. By the time the guns fell silent here in November 1918, there was nary a tree standing, let alone a barn, a hill or a house. One description I read said that Ypres was shelled with firebombs up to 20 grenades per minute, which rained like hail onto the buildings. And the landscape was rendered absolutely unrecognisable too, from the scars of total war. Plans to rebuild the town exactly as it was before World War I began, even before 1918. Winston Churchill, though, wanted to buy the town and leave it in ruins as a huge decimated monument to the thousands of British and Empire troops who'd fought and died here. But it was an argument he didn't win. Every brick, every crack in the pavement, every cobblestone seems to have been put back in place as it was before the very first shell was even fired. It's like going back in time, and it feels like a town built of and on war, including its industry, which is largely battlefield tourism, or as I like to call it, remembrance in the field. But back to Cloth Hall now. Inside is the In Flanders Fields Museum, set up to immerse people in the World War I experience in minute, captivating detail. After a few hours inside, though, I lose Oliver and eventually stumble out, blinking in the light. Now I find myself at the door of the In Flanders Fields Research Centre. It's filled with natural light, tons of books, maps and databases, also some kind historians. I knock on the door and walk inside.
We are in the research center of In Flanders Fields Museum. My name is Pieter Troch. I'm a historian, a researcher attached to the research center of the museum.
So we're trying to find out where my relative, my great uncle, his real name is Richard, but he listed under the name of Charles Spencer, died. So it was on the 31st of January 1918, and this was a strange time, wasn't it? Because there were no major battles actually happening in Ypres at that time.
That's correct. There were no major battles, but this does not mean that there was no fighting. Both parties tried to establish their positions after 100 days battle, and I think, well, it's just during those moments that he must have been killed by shelling.
From 1914 to 18, there were five major battles in and around Ypres, as it was known, in World War I. Eventually, five Australian infantry divisions took part, volunteers all. The 100 days battle Peter refers to, in which the Australians took part, also known as the Third Battle of Ypres, began on July 31st, 1917 and went until the 10th of November, taking in the weather of both summer and winter, including a rainy period the likes of which Ypres hadn't seen in 30 years. Richard, I found out later, hadn't entered the trenches to fight until January that year, most probably due to his young age. Prior to that, he'd been attached to a training camp for unit reinforcements, helping to run it. Now, in Ypres, he was one.
So the goal of this battle was to force a breakthrough. That was the goal, the aim of the major summer offensive of the Allied forces.
And Richard would have been in that 100-day battle, most likely.
Of course. He must have taken part with the 14th Australian Infantry Battalion in many phases. First, you had the prelude with the Battle of Messines, where the Australian forces were engaged, and then during several stages in the war, in this battle, the Australian units were involved, mainly in September 1917, Battle of the Menin Road, but afterwards Battle at Broodseinde, Polygon Wood, and so on.
So it'll be some time before I get a chance to access Richard's war service record, which turns out to be an incredible and tragic journey into a life cut short. Right now, though, Peter's about to reach for the unit war diary of that fateful day in January 1918, another revealing resource that right until this very moment I didn't even know existed. I'm both exhilarated and a little apprehensive about what we might find.
Have a seat. That's the interesting thing. So it was on the 31st, you see? Fuzzlier dugouts is I was not able to locate it on a, well, as it is only a small place on the map. Fuzzlier's dugouts,
okay.
Yeah.
Yep. So, Peter's just revealed the where. Fusilier's dugout, a concrete pillbox or field fortification that had been originally built and used by German soldiers, then taken by the Australians as they'd pushed north on the salient post-Battle of Messines in June. It's buried deep in a forest, less than 5 kilometres from where we're sitting right now. This is where Richard was hit.
And this is a page from...
One of the official war diaries of the time, written by a clerk of the 14th Battalion of the Australian Infantry Force. And it says, 31st of January 1918, foggy observation bed. Enemy again shelled fusilier dugouts with gas shells. Large number of the garrison affected and sent to RAP, Regimental Aid Post, for treatment.
This describes the incident that took the life of Richard Spencer. He would have been among the 56 other ranks who were involved in this.
And taken to the, Regimental Aid Post for treatment after being gassed.
And there it is, the what, as recorded in black and white by the unit clerk almost 100 years ago to the day from this very moment.
This is killed and wounded, and they make a distinction between the gas casualties, which is, which is very confronting, of course, with 2 officers and 56 other ranks gassed. The Germans were shelling their positions.
On the 31st of January 1918.
So he got wounded here, he got probably shelled here, then was evacuated, and just outside the forest you have 2 cemeteries, amongst them Spoilbank Cemetery, where there was an advanced dressing station of the Australian units, and I think he must have been evacuated to that dressing station and then died of his wounds.
So where he's buried at Spoilbank Cemetery is more or less where he died.
Where he died, of wounds. Because it's behind the front line. Once he got wounded in the front line, you are taken out of the line by stretcher bearers, taken to the 1st Regimental Aid Post. There was a whole organization of medical services behind the lines, and for those who didn't make it, they were buried at spot just next to some medical aid post.
I'm stunned. It's right now, but it feels like right then. And in an instant, the mystery has been solved in the worst possible way. And I think of Mary, his mother. Did she know? Am I possibly the first in the family to find out what happened to Richard? It's a very strange feeling to be the receiver of this tragic knowledge about a man I never knew, but whose memory has loomed so large for generations.
I have absolute goosebumps, I have to say. Like, can I just ask you, as an historian, I'm the next person straight after a family from, I think, regional New South Wales who spent time with you going over their relative and doing literally detective work, trying to find out what happened. What is this job like for you when people like me just literally walking off the street and you help them piece this together?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that question, I think. In this museum, the emphasis is on the impact of that war on human beings and the landscape, and on the destruction that results from war. We try to tell this story, what war does then, but also now. That's the reflection, that's the stepping stone to the other conflicts, as the face of war does not change through time. So we try to show people what war does, and this history is so important, as there was no Second World War without the First World War. The First World War was called the very first industrialized war, with men with an attitude of the 19th century fighting with weapons of the 20th century. And the consequences of that, we know that, with hundreds, thousands of dead, millions of dead. And
how many Australians died?
16,000 in Belgium alone. Altogether, you have approximately 600,000 dead linked to the Belgian battlefields. That is, all parties together. So more than 60 different nationalities coming from 5 different continents came here to fight, left their traces, very often with a grave. And that's why nowadays people from all those countries still come to visit these battlefields. And that's very important. You have to be able to shift your perspective from the sorrow of one family, of one dead, to the bigger picture. That's what we try to show or to tell in this museum.
So my quest, as I mentioned, this exercise in historical empathy. And lest we forget, and I think we're at a point in history now where we're starting to forget, and we're seeing this with the changes in politics around the world. What happens if we do forget? Or is it important, this work you're doing, and why?
Yeah, of course it's
keeping
important.
Keeping us to remember.
And we try to approach this history departing from questions of today, questions of war, questions of refugees, migration, because you only have refugees when you have war.
And refugees were created during this war too, right?
Of course, Of course. More than, as for the Belgians alone, 1.5 million. And the problems they faced, or the struggle they had to go through, were very much the same or similar than today, or other struggles of refugees during the 20th century. So the reason why we focus on the impact of war on the human experience is because this brings the biggest possible audience into contact with the subject of war. I mean, everyone can imagine, like you say, historical empathy with a personal story about a woman with a child being a refugee or a soldier or
dying a horrible death like Richard did.
Being gassed on the 31st of January 1918 must have felt the same as civilian casualties or soldiers or gassed today in Syria, for instance. What does this mean? Is this the way to solve problems, or should we turn to diplomacy and human understanding?
Peter also said that Richard's involvement in World War I would have most certainly influenced his younger brother Harry's decision, my grandfather, to join up in World War II. Likely his other brothers as well.
The earliest recollections of happenings that I have is when my two brothers, Hugh and Richard, the twins, went to the 1914-18 war. I can recall they were both cigarette smokers. Ashtrays were not available in the house, so my mother improvised with a saucer for each of them, placed on a chair alongside their beds. During one of their weekend leave periods, my brother Nathaniel and I crawled quietly and took a couple of cigarettes from their packs, also some butts that had been left in the saucers. We both hid out in the fowl pen and smoked the cigarettes without being ill, and that started both of us as smokers. I continued to smoke from then until 1976, a period of 60 years.
Can you imagine? And as a matter of fact, on this pilgrimage, I keep hearing those three words, can you imagine, everywhere I go. I guess that's what it's all about, isn't it? And in the museum, I find myself looking deeply into the historical photographs, wondering if Richard might be among the columns of weary soldiers marching in the mud. Oddly, there are no enlistment photos of Richard from this time, only of Hugh, his identical twin, who returned. And this is what I go on. Although the war was in its last year, it continues for another 10 months after Richard's death. He'd made it so far, but he was not there at the end. And I also find time suddenly contracting into before and after January 31st, 1918. It's very strange. Now I'm really hungry to find out more, as if to paint Richard somehow back into existence while I'm here in Flanders Fields. I'm also acutely aware of how lucky I am. Mary and the rest of the Spencer family at that time had to grieve for Richard from afar. In this very different time of technology, ease, and mobility, I have this opportunity to be here, unlike them, to visit his grave in person, which I'm about to do right now with the help of a very passionate and knowledgeable local who brings his lived experience to his work as a battlefield guide here in Ypres.
My name is Conrad Dumoulin. It's a French name. Mm-hmm. It's a very common name in France and also here in Belgium.
And you're here, you're from this region, Zillebeek?
Yes, I'm originally from Langemark, where is the German cemetery. As a young boy, I was raised seeing all these military cemeteries, and it took my attention, and then that is why I started studying and reading and becoming a local guide.
Wow, so this is really part of you?
Yes, yes. Yeah. We cycle, we walk along, and we see all these cemeteries, the British cemeteries, 197 around Ypres. Only, unfortunately, only one German cemetery left before. At the end of the war, there were also 178 German cemeteries, of course, with a lot of history.
The village of Zillebeek's just a few kilometres down the road from Spoilbank Cemetery, where we're now standing. The cemetery was named after the heaps of dirt, or banks of spoil, that were thrown up when the canal was originally dug out, starting in the 1890s. Conrad says that it was a hotspot for hard fighting between the British and German armies, especially during the Third Battle of Ypres.
Further up in the wood, you have the bluff, which was the highest point, let's say a spoil bank of 9 meters high, which was the only location in the Ypres salient that was held by British troops. So a lot of fighting went on, a lot of mining operations, and finally in April 1916, the German troops tunnels, they blew up the whole, let's say, the bluff spoil bank, which is now has become a crater landscape. In 1917, the Third Battle of Ypres, of course, it was taken by the British troops, but then retaken by the Germans in March 1918.
With 520 graves of Commonwealth soldiers, it's one of the smaller military cemeteries in Ypres. Under the name of Private Charles Spencer, Richard is buried here, along with 66 other Australians, one unknown.
So we're at Spoilbank Cemetery, which was established in 1915 as a military cemetery, is that right?
Yes, yep. As part of the operations ongoing on the bluff. So troopers that were killed or wounded were buried here in this cemetery from 1915 onwards.
So this is what I can see right now. Rows of vivid white headstones pop in the light against an immaculate green lawn. Red roses are everywhere. A tall military monument stands silently in their midst next to a low fence. And beyond that is lush green farmland.
1415.
So what would this cemetery have looked like back then? Because we're walking into a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery now, and I believe they came in the early 1920s and established and fixed up all these cemeteries and made them look good and, you know, like a military cemetery should after a great war, a world war. But what would this have looked like then if we're standing here in 1918 when my relative was killed and buried here? What would it have looked like?
A muddy place.
Any headstones?
No headstones, planks and crosses. And shot up by German artillery time by time.
Wow.
Gas shells would be exploding here, high explosive shells, shrapnel. So even those who were buried had no rest. They could be torn up. As you see here, these headstones have just the markers believed to be buried. So this is a casualty from the 19th of July 1917, believed to be buried in this cemetery. It means once Private Riley was, or Gunner Riley was buried here, but his remains were lost because of bombardments by the artillery in later operations.
Wow.
So his remains, human remains, must have been scattered around. And after the war, they knew by the register of the cemetery that Gunner Riley had been buried here, but they didn't find him. So that's why they put a marker on side of the walls, believed to be buried in this cemetery.
So no rest for the dead, even then?
No, wow. Certainly not. Certainly not.
Wow.
You cannot imagine what a tragedy the battlefield was when it was, let's say, left after the war in 1919. So it was an area, a muddy area, because Ypres, the underground of Ypres, is clay. It means the water is not sippling through. Due to the tremendous bombardments, because from 1916 they were shelling each other with millions of shell, so the whole surface was torn up. The drainage system, the ditches, were damaged. And when it started pouring rain, the water stayed on top of the ground. And it became a mirage, a quagmire.
It was like a swamp, wasn't it?
A swamp.
It's so quiet and peaceful here, adding to the sadness of what Conrad describes. So now we start for where Richard's laid to rest.
So we're in the row now, plot 2. Row C.
Grave number five. We have him, Charles Spencer. Private, 14th Battalion Australian Infantry. So he belonged to the 4th Division, the 4th Brigade, and killed in action the 31st of January 1918. And there's an epitaph by the family, because the Imperial War Graves Commission, they knew that the families would see this design of the cemeteries as very military. You must also know that no one of the fallen was allowed to be brought home, except one, that was the unknown soldier. No exhumation and repatriation. All of them had to stay where they fell, in Gallipoli, everywhere, in the Balkans, in the Western Front, in the Somme, in Ypres. So no one was brought home, except the unknown soldiers. So they allowed the families to have a personal attachment on the headstone. And this is called the epitaph. And the epitaph can have a maximum of 4 lines. So we see that your family made the wish, duty noble done. You see?
Yeah.
That is because your family asked for that to be put on the headstone.
Duty nobly done. Well, having heard the feisty tone of Mary's letter before, I now have the very strong feeling that it would have been her to have asked for these somewhat defiant words as Richard's epitaph. In the end, she did get her son's victory and commemorative medals from the army, but it took close to 4 years from the day he lost his life here near Zillebeek. The war had thrown the world into chaos, and these were not the days of email or Snapchat either.
And he really had a twin brother.
Yes.
A twin brother who survived,
yes,
in the 7th Battalion.
Yes.
So one may not forget that the divisions fought in the line. A division is 10 to 12,000 men, a battalion 1,000 men. There was hardly any communication at that time. It's not like you would take a mobile phone and say, I'm here on the Western Front. No. So you can imagine that his brother, being in another division and another battalion, would have no knowledge about what happened to his brother.
Conrad, of course, is 100% right, as Harry writes in his memoir. The very last time and only time Richard and Hugh met during their time on the Western Front as soldiers, they only saw each other for 10 minutes, sharing news from home.
Hugh did not know of Dick being killed in action until he arrived back in Australia as a cot case to go to hospital after the war had ceased.
While we're looking at Richard's grave, I wonder if he's the youngest person buried at Spoilbank. He's not. Conrad shows me the grave of a young British soldier who was 15. Looking at his headstone and the sea of others, I can't help but feel conflicted, confronted now by the military reality and the harshness of a soldier's life here, and the inconceivably huge losses on both sides, something like over 9 million military deaths in World War I alone, with the Australian casualty rate one of the highest. Quoting a war memorial statistic, on average, 38 members of the Australian Armed Forces died per day during the 1,560 days of World War I. It's quite overwhelming, and of course, all I can think of is, what a waste of precious life. But there's not a lot of room for this kind of mushy stuff on or in a battlefield. So I fess up to Conrad about my conflicted thoughts and feelings and ask him what he thinks.
I'm pro-remembering, but I'm really, really anti-war.
I understand. Yeah. I understand. I fully understand. Yeah. Because that is the thing, us as guides,
yeah,
and I told you, me being grown up, seeing the battlefields, I had 2 grandfathers in the First World War, serving in the Belgian Army 1913 as infantrymen trained, and then rolling straight into the war with the occupation of the Rhine, dismissed 1919. So I heard this man when I was a boy of 7-8 years old. They spoke to me about all the things that happened at the Iser Front. Sometimes it seems as we lost the emotional part, but it's not true. There is, and I can understand you. And I think you have to split, let's say, emotions from the facts. You have to learn, when you come here to the battlefields, you learn about facts. And there's nothing wrong with facts and figures, or to learn about the hardship and the military aspect of the whole operation. A war is not conducted by weak men. It is hard, hard, tough job. But then you are allowed in the evening or at home to have your emotions. But when you're here, first thing, and that's what I want to do as a guide, you will not hear from me that much emotional things. I'm going to the historical facts, and then later on you can put them in place, and then you can realize what these men have endured. You cannot blame the military commanders that they were so hard going in operations, as well the German part as the Allied part. It is up to politicians to make decisions, to go for diplomacy and make peace, but also to have a strong peacekeeping if necessary.
Well, it might not surprise you to find out that before he became a guide, Konrad served in EU peacekeeping missions in the Balkans and the Middle East. He deliberately calls his tours pilgrim tours, not war tourism, and sees them part of a process of peace and reconciliation. This is more than guiding, he told me. So it's about searching for your family roots.
Much quicker in Russia than the German higher command.
Now, in case you're wondering where Oliver is, he's here too, silently walking among the headstones, also reflecting on the epic losses of this war. As a German, Ypres had a big effect on him as well. Konrad told me that he doesn't see many Germans out here, so he makes a beeline to chat to him, which they do for ages.
Yeah. And the powder was already there.
Yeah.
So here you have.
And after I get back to Australia, he sends me a photo of Fusilier's dugout, the place that Richard was shelled, which he finds on his own time. Every time I pass by Spoorbank Cemetery, he writes, I think about your great uncle and his story. I'm incredibly moved. A week or so after I leave Ypres, with some time and decent internet access, I finally find out exactly what happened that fateful day in January to Richard. Sitting at a friend's kitchen table through the Australian War Memorial website, I stumble onto a series of eyewitness accounts taken in the months after Richard's death. As I discover through memorial historian Dr. Aaron Pegram, the Red Cross Wounded and Missing Inquiry Bureau bridged the information gap between distraught families in Australia and the army in an attempt to give closure to those with a loved one listed as missing or killed in action during World War I. 10 statements are taken, pretty much all saying the same thing. Taken on the 23rd of May 1919, this is what Private W.C. Smith says about the incident. I knew casualty. He was a tall man, slightly built, fair complexion, about 19 years of age. Casualty was playing cards on the support lines. I was playing in the same party. A gas shell exploded in the dugout where we were, killing casualty instantly. He was most severely wounded in the head, and I was gassed by the same shell. He was buried near Spoilbank, but I did not see his grave. Some of the other informants wrote that they did attend his funeral. Can you imagine? So Oliver's and my time here in Ypres is finally winding up. But on our last night, I decide to return to the Menin Gate one last time, to attend the last post again, and to see who I can find to talk to, fellow pilgrims I might have seen around the fields, or others, strangers I'm yet to meet. I'm really interested to hear why they are here, in this vast, living, breathing place and space of remembrance. And I have to say, I'm so glad I did.
We are from Newcastle with the Fusiliers, visiting all the graves.
First, I meet a tour group from Newcastle in England. They're with the Northumberland Fusiliers, who are part of tonight's last post-military ceremony.
And why are you here?
Well, it's a battlefield tour.
Battlefield tour.
Do you think it's important for us to keep remembering this? Oh, why? Why? I mean, there's 400 people here tonight. Why is it?
We could end up with another war like we had, if you don't remember what happened and how it happened, and you know, it's a warning, really, you know.
I think it's extremely important to remember, and it's particularly important to educate the young children who've been here tonight. At the end of the day, no soldier wants to fight a war, and if we can stop that happening, which is just a form of bullying, really, then I think everybody would agree that the peace is what we're after. And by remembering events like that, it just you realise how important it has been to all of these guys to fight for our freedom.
There was a puppy and a card from an Australian great-nephew thanking his great-granddad 102 years ago today, it said. Now, if a great-nephew can come from Australia to do that, it's just amazing.
Then I meet a British woman who regularly visits the grave of someone she doesn't even know, all the way from Tasmania.
Where are you from, Ruth?
I'm from the New Forest in Hampshire in England.
And we're standing underneath the Menin Gate, and we've just both witnessed the last post that they have here every night. What was that like for you?
It's quite emotional. I've been before, but it is still quite emotional, especially as we'd been out to Tyne Cot this afternoon.
Which is a cemetery, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And that was our main reason for coming, as we wanted to revisit, as we found a grave by chance some years ago. And we didn't have a very good tour guide when we came out the previous time, which I do think it was meant to be. As we were short on time, we didn't go right down the bottom of the cemetery. We popped over the wall and then came to a halt. And then we both looked down, and my husband's Robin, as I'm Ruth. And so, of course, our initial is R and our surname is Crouch. And we looked down at the grave we were stood in front of, and it was R Crouch, which took our breath away a bit. Since leaving that time, I've done a lot of research on the gentleman in question, who was only 19 and his name was Raymond. I've been in touch with the Huon News in Tasmania, and they've just to let them know that somebody was visiting on the centenary, more than anything, you know, who's got the same name.
Now I've got goosebumps.
It's extremely special. As I take veterans and youngsters around the battlefields, it's too easy to say there was 10,000 here, 11,000 there. But imagine those men lined up on a road, and just imagine them all going at one point. And if you can think like that, it makes it really special. They were fathers, brothers, uncles. You know, they meant something to all of those families. It's not just the guys who died. The sacrifice that they made is an extension of the family sacrifice that went on from all our nations. You know, they have fought for the freedoms that we enjoy to carry out ceremonies like this, and it must go on in perpetuity as far as I'm concerned.
And then Eureka. I come across an entire high school class from the Netherlands. They're from a grammar school called Atlas College, and they're studying the poets of World War I. It's their teacher Andrew's 13th trip bringing the students to the battlefields of Ypres. Thinking back on the excursions I used to go on, I can't help wondering if they've come there willingly or been dragged there kicking and screaming because they had to.
So, why are you guys here?
Sure. Well, I think to know more about the Great War and to really know what they've been through, because we also went to the trenches, and then you can look at pictures, but when you're really there, you really get the feeling and you know more about it, and I think you can pay more respect to it because you know more about it.
How did it make you feel when you were going through the trenches and you were imagining what these young men went through?
Well, it was a bit surreal because it was very muddy, and knowing that they had it worse and we already didn't enjoy it that much because of the mud, it was really strange. Just imagine the hell they've been through. Well, it's just sad to think about it, and that they died at our age.
They were your age, some of them. My great uncle was 18 when he died here.
Well, I'm 17, almost 18, so it's strange.
Perched on a nearby wall after the last post, it turns out that like the Fusiliers, the students have also been part of tonight's ceremony at the Menin Gate.
What about you?
Well, I feel a bit removed from the ceremony itself. I think, honestly, it's a bit too commercial. Like buying the poppies, and I think it's a bit overdone. Mm-hmm. I think it should be more personal. That's basically what I think about the ceremony.
What I'm doing here is I'm making a personal project about historical empathy, trying to find out more by walking in my ancestors' shoes, because I've never been through a situation like that. And I'm also seeing the world changing around me, where I think we perhaps are forgetting about this. Does anyone have any comments on what they think about the power of remembering might be?
Well, I'm their teacher, and what I know is
whatever opinions are, that doesn't matter. It's all about placing yourself in the context that you're in yourself. These kids are all Dutch. They don't have that ancestry. I do, as an Englishman. I have a great-grandfather who fought here. And that obviously might be a lot of the reason why I send my kids here as well, the students that I have. But for every single one, I know it's something you never forget. And it's not about being pro-war or anti-war, but it's realizing that this happened and that it still happens today, and at least be able to think about it and take that time. It's almost mindfulness, taking the time to allow yourself to have 1 or 2 minutes to just think and place yourself in a context of war, really.
But it's not one size fits all out here. Not everyone comes to the sprawling, tragic battlefields of Ypres to remember for the same reasons or in the same way. So I ask Andrew about that.
Well, there's a lot of discussion about that. Are we celebrating the dead heroes, or are we commemorating the tragic loss? You know, are we talking about the butchers' generals that sent these poor kids out to slaughter, or are we remembering the heroic deeds and a forgotten victory? Because the Australians, the British, won. We actually won. That is totally not what it's about. It's about knowing that that is the discussion. About my kids knowing that this is something that is happening to them. Of course there's something happening here when somebody commemorates and at the same time we're waging wars. So what is happening there? But at the same time, I've been here with kids who joined the army afterwards. So it's not as if I'm telling them an anti-war story. It's about realizing that this is part of this world, tragically so, but it is. I think, you know, the moment a teacher decided to teach Anne Frank is the moment a teacher hoped never again. And the mystery of your neighbor selling you out for 7 guilders and you ending up in a concentration camp, can we really guarantee that reading Anne Frank or taking people to the Menin Gate and visiting the battlefields that won't happen again? I don't know. But at least we can kind of try waking students up to the dialogue.
So it's the possibility.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you want to say something? Thank you.
Well, I think that if everyone would do this in school, then the possibility of it happening again would be a lot smaller. I think it would be very unlikely that this kind of massive slaughter on this scale would happen again if everyone came here and saw monuments like this.
Just before leaving these inspiring young people, a young woman called Lida Vey asks me if she can say something.
I think that actually going here to Ypres makes it so much more real, because when you read about the First World War and the Second World War and you see that there are millions of casualties, but when you actually come here you can see each grave, each stone, and it's just so massive. It makes it all so much more real, and that's why it adds so much value to your knowledge, I think.
And when you look at what's happening in the world, do you think we're in danger of forgetting what happened in these huge conflicts?
Maybe a little bit. I think that people, especially like governments, think too easily about big weapons, like nuclear weapons. We have weapons that could just blow up half the planet. Like, it could do so much damage, and we have them. Humanity made them. And we could just start a war that's even more destructive and so dangerous that we still have those weapons, and that our warfare is so advanced that we could easily kill each other so quickly. And I think that we are forgetting what happened here. And of course, everything happened here with technology that was from a century ago. But now we have this modern day technology and it's even more dangerous. So I really do think that we are forgetting what's at stake and how easily we could lose it with all of those weapons.
To Richard Charles Spencer, with pride and appreciation, I have asked that this be read at your gravesite at Spoilbank Cemetery, over 16,000 kilometres from your home and family in Melbourne. This year marks the 100th year since your death in a dugout at Fusilier Wood near Hollebeck in Belgium. At 19 years of age, you were so young. You did not have the opportunity to celebrate your 21st birthday or to have a family of your own, But we, the descendants of your younger brother Nat, will always remember you with sorrow, but also with pride. I've read letters written by your mother following your death and am touched by the heart-wrenching sorrow that she felt in losing her son so far from home. She was also very proud of you and your brothers, who also fought in both the First and Second World Wars. This will be read by a student from your homeland, and for that I am grateful. You gave your today so that we can all have tomorrow's. You will not be forgotten. From your great-niece, Jo Whiteman, niece Spencer, and your great-great-niece and nephew, Madison and Mitchell.
Well, I might be the first Spencer to visit Richard's grave, but I certainly won't be the last. And I feel as if I've become a better person by coming here to Ypres. It's given me great perspective. And as Conrad pointed out to me, Richard is an inextricable part of the landscape here. And also that, as I'd travelled such a long way to be here, it means my ties to Ypres must also run very deep. And I'd never really considered this before. But I guess that's what pilgrimages are for, to bring these seldom contemplated ideas about things like connection to family, to place, and to others, interconnectedness, to the fore. Some say it's what you bring to a place that gives it its meaning, and others say it's what the place brings to you. Place is also about what we leave behind. And if you'll indulge me just for a second, travel and pilgrimage researcher Dr. Alex Norman says, at meaningful places, we can take something of the perspective of what has happened at that place. That these sites underscore our physical presence. In other words, we become part of the story of that place and it becomes part of us simply by going there. Also that we leave our traces behind. You bring you to the place, he told me when I rang him to ask more. But you also leave an imprint, like footsteps on the Camino. Each new one changes the landscape just a little more. Certainly being in Ypres, this place that has become incredibly meaningful to me, I hope to have left tangible gratitude, appreciation, and new understanding. And listening to what the landscape whispered to me while I was there has given me a very embodied sense of what family is, what history is, and above all, what remembrance is and why it's so important, which I'm really keen to unpack even further with the help of historians, other people, other pilgrims, once I get back to Australia in a few weeks' time, which you'll hear next episode and across the remainder of From a Whisper to a Bang. Speaking today were Peter Toh, Conrad Dumoulin, Graham and Peter from the Northumberland Fusiliers Tour Group, Ruth Crouch, and Andrew Niemeyer and the students of Atlas College from Holland. You also heard the voices of Heath Big and Joanne Whiteman. From a Whisper to a Bang is a podcast produced and presented by me, Megan Spencer, for the Australian War Memorial. Series music is by talented Cretan Australian duo Zuluris White, with additional music this episode from The Digger's Requiem, arranged, curated and conducted by Chris Latham, musical artist in residence at the Australian War Memorial and as performed in Amiens, France, by Orchestre de Picardie and the Jena Philharmonic Orchestra with Australian soloists. And the 62,000 bells that you can hear right now were also part of the Requiem. The track includes one bell for every fallen Australian in World War I. It was recorded at the ANU School of Music in Canberra, performed by Veronica Bailey, Thomas Lau and Chris Latham. Huge thanks to Chris and all of the Digger's Requiem composers and artists. Find out more about this collaborative project at theflowersofwar.org. Additional sound this episode by Jeremy Conlon, with additional music by Michael Sheriffs. Mastering is by Chris Keogh. And grateful thanks to everyone involved in this episode. And for the full list of credits, acknowledgements, and for more details about this episode, please visit the From a Whisper to a Bang page at the Australian War Memorial website, awm.gov.au. And you can also subscribe to this podcast on your favourite podcast app. And thank you again for taking the time to listen. Speak to you again next episode.